Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this episode of Excess Returns, Jack and I talk with Jerry Parker, trend follower and founder of Chesapeake Capital Corporation, about his personal approach to investing in his portfolio. Jerry walks us through his investing goals in his portfolio and why trend following works for him and his clients. The use of trend and risk management techniques are paramount in his approach, and Jerry explains why these two disciplined trading methods are important in helping to limit human biases and emotions and are built to handle many different types of market environments. We talked to Jerry about his new ETF, the benefits of trend in an ETF wrapper, and more about how Jerry approaches financial decisions with respect to his children in the past, charitable giving, and more. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with Jerry Parker of Chesapeake Capital Corporation. Hi, Jerry. How are you? Thank you very much for joining us again.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's good to be here. Good to see you guys again.
In this discussion, we wanted to have you on to talk about your personal investment strategy and portfolio. This is kind of one of the episodes or one of the things that we do on Excess Returns is we like to have investment professionals on like yourself that have been in the markets and talk about how you think about your own personal portfolio, how you invest your own money, some of the unique things that you might do or consider given that you are in the business of investments and, you know, providing the types of strategies that you provide to investors. And so a lot of times when we sit down with folks like yourself, you know, the strategies actually are very different and unique because of those circumstances. You know, it's probably not like a 60-40 portfolio or something like that, that a lot of investors might be in. I mean, you take a different approach to investing just at the outset. So anyways, thank you for coming on. Thanks for, you know, being open with us and our audience. And I think this is going to be a really, really good discussion.
Great, great.
So before we get into the strategy and the specifics, let's sort of start at a, I guess, a higher level, like when, you know, like almost like a financial advisor would start with talking to a potential investor, which is when you think about your own personal portfolio and investments, what do you consider to be the biggest goals and objectives with your money?
Well, you know, I made a lot of money early on or halfway through my career. And so ever since then, it's really just preservation. You know, you just don't want to go backwards. It's really kind of a pride and ego type of a thing. You know, you want to be moving forward all the time and increasing your wealth, you know, and that could be part of that's going to be invested in my own trading and funds that I have, ETFs, mutual funds, private fund, creating, supporting new funds and products that I want to come out with. So I'm very keen on these new ideas and new products being successful, not just put substantial amounts of money, my money in there. I want to support them and get them going, but also I want to make money. But really it's, I think when you have a lot of, you know, when you make good money and you start, you're like, wow, I'm really making some good money here. My sort of goal was like, hey, let's don't go backwards too much. You know, these drawdowns become very personal when you have a certain amount of wealth and then you suffer through the drawdown, the clients will be complaining, you know, and you're like, let me tell you, I feel it probably as much or more than anybody. Because usually with my funds, I'm usually one of the biggest, if not the biggest investor in the fund.
Do you think when you were younger, you understood the true power of compounding?
Oh, no, I didn't understand a lot of things. You know, one of my problems was, you know, I didn't have mentors in my, I'm making money, I'm building a big business or a business and money is kind of coming in and we're really growing. And I remember telling my wife, she was like, how much are we worth? And I told her and she was like totally shocked. You know, she's like, oh my God. And I'm like, yeah, I know. We just hit a really good spell there in the mid 2000s, you know. And but I didn't have mentors or family members who were helping me with this. And so I didn't understand a lot of things about the pressures of wealth and, all the things that come with it. And I was very naive and unprepared for, the family stuff, friends stuff, and diversification. And
I think that that's probably a challenge that a lot of people face when they have success earlier in their careers. And it's like they have to kind of learning by doing, or hopefully you have the right people around you to help guide you and steer you in the best possible direction. We were talking before we jumped on, and it's your birthday soon. I'm not going to say exactly when it is because I don't know if you want that out, but happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you.
But what that also means is that you are going to be a year older. And, and that probably means a year, it definitely means a year closer to retirement. Now, you may not be planning on retiring anytime soon, just given what I know about you and given the things that you're involved with some of these new partnerships and business lines that you're launching. But do you ever think about retirement and how you want your sort of optimal retirement to be? I mean, do you envision yourself out in a golf course, hitting the golf ball, or, going on cruises multiple times a year, or doing tons of traveling? I mean, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't think about retiring, honestly. I just can't imagine not getting up every morning and digging into the markets and seeing what's going on in my portfolio and having clients and having a fund and being in the game. I don't know. I sort of think about people in the business. Obviously, there are people in this business who are older than me, and they're pretty old, and they're really seemingly just doing as well as they've ever done. So that's what I think about. Maybe I want to be like that. I'm just consumed, with my interest, which is the business and trading the markets and the systematic trend following and worldwide and the stocks, the currencies, commodities, interest rates, and just being part of that, and being a relevant human and keeping abreast of everything that's going on in my portfolio and watching the world unfold. What I've done for almost 40 years, I just can't imagine not doing that. But, I work out a lot too. And so I get on this treadmill, and I've done it for over 20 years, these weightlifting and, yoga and a treadmill. And I just say to myself every now and then, I'll bet you one of these days I'm going to step off that treadmill and say, this is it. I'm just going to enjoy life. I'm going to eat a lot. I'm going to drink a lot. I'm going to turn my back on all of my diet and fitness. And maybe I'll do the same thing, with trading and say, okay, today it's enough. And it may not even be a bad period. It may just be, I'm at the top of my game, but I've lost the intensity, but I doubt it, But that's, I think, would have to be something like that. Just all of a sudden get to a certain age or mentality that's I've never experienced before and say, hey, I'm done. It's over with. I don't plan on that happening. I'm having too much fun. And believe it or not, what I have done for all these years, I do it because it is the most fun thing to do. And that is sit in front of the computer and watch the markets and talk to my friends about trading or what is proper trading. And just too much fun. Can't stop.
Well, you've kept our perfect streak going because we tend to talk to pretty driven people on the podcast, but I don't think anybody yet has said they're going to retire in the traditional sense. I think everybody has said, I'm going to keep doing this to some degree. So, and I think it's such a huge part, for all of us. I think about this myself too. Like, it's part of our purpose in life. I mean, keeping your mind going, doing something you love, it's part of your purpose. And if you kind of just flip the switch and turn that off, like, I think that would be pretty problematic for me.
Yeah, like I said, you'd have to all of a sudden become another person, a different type of person. So it can happen, and it wouldn't be anything wrong with it. Like I said, it could be when I am at the top of the game or I'm in a big losing streak and I'm just had enough. But I don't know. Anything can happen, but I doubt if it will happen. I don't really have a lot of outside interest. I like to play pickleball. I like to go to nice dinners. I don't play golf. So yeah, I have to find something to fall in love with. And I don't see that thing on the horizon.
Before we ask you about your portfolio, I want to ask you about the way most people traditionally build their portfolios. You know, they get their stocks, they get their bonds, they get an allocation between the two, they get a glide path, and that sort of ends up being their portfolio they invest for the long term. And I know you invest in a very different way. So I'm just wondering, what do you think are the flaws in that 60-40 stock and bond portfolio?
Oh, wow. Well, this is like a softball. You know, I can hit this one out of the park. Although, you know, it's not that many people who will kind of agree with me, you know, but the flaws are long only, you know. Sometimes, like last year, we got to be short the stocks. We got to be short the bonds. There's no place to hide in 2022 in a traditional portfolio because everything got crushed. So you've got to have shorts. That's like one of the most important things I learned. And it keeps reappearing. I trade a lot of single stocks, but I also short a lot of stocks as well. So on a bad day like today, or the past, this month has been kind of bad for stocks, you know, you really love to come in with some nice shorts on. Just two markets is not enough. You know, the stocks and the bonds, you need to have some currencies and commodities. Those are great markets. They trend well. I don't believe that stocks are inherently better or better trenders or better performers in any way. They're just the same as the bonds and the currencies and the commodities. So I'm very conservative. You know, I majored in accounting. I was in public accounting. And I wanted both. I want to have both. I want to have tremendous safety, which is what you get with the systematic, diversified CTA, trend following exposure. And then I want to have a good upside and no compromise on being incredibly safe. And the diversification gives you both, you know, with the safety, the longs and the shorts. And then you're monitoring all these markets and you're looking at your trend following systems that are going to get you long and short the markets that are moving. And so you'll have some good opportunity to make good money. So I have nothing in my portfolio that's sort of buy and hold or long only, except, you know, too much real estate. I think this happens the older you get and you keep buying property. And oh yeah, you should buy the property next door. Wow. You know, I've done that a few times as well. So people always advise you to do that. When it comes up for sale, buy the lot next door, or buy the house next door. So too much real estate. And, you know, it violates a big principle, which is it's not liquid. And I can't take a small loss like I can with my futures trading and trend following trading. So, but yeah, that's kind of an issue, I think, in my portfolio. I without a lot of good planning, I've sort of ended up with a lot of liquidity for half my assets and, you know, in the funds. And then the other half is in real estate. And Florida real estate has done well, and real estate in general has done well, but that's going to end one of these days. And I kind of know better, which is be prepared to take a small loss and get out and not hold on to things. But now I'm with the real estate, I'm not able to do that with a significant part of my portfolio.
Well, I want to dig into the real estate a little bit more later, but I want to ask you a little bit more about the stocks and bonds. Why do you think, you know, one of the things that's been interesting to me is as we talk to people, you know, we've talked to people who run risk parity strategies. We talked to Corey Hofstein, who does return stacking. We talked to you with trend following. Like, when you look at these strategies, they all seem to have better risk-adjusted return characteristics than any variation of a stock and bond portfolio. But yet the vast majority of individual investors are running the stock and bond portfolios. I'm wondering, why do you think that is?
It's they don't know a lot about anything other than that. Long only. The media tells them that's great, and you just got to hold on to it and buy the dips. And they're in it with all of their friends as well. So if we all lose when stocks go down or bonds go down, we're all losing. So I don't really feel that bad. An investment in a CTA or an alternative, you know, you could be out there on your own and underperforming, and you'll feel really bad about it. Yeah, so, you know, it's the obvious answer is, I think, easy to do. It's really difficult to lose a lot of money, too, in stocks and bonds historically, which I think branching out into other types of investments, you know, you put yourself, people probably had some bad experiences with some bad alternatives.
Yeah, and what's interesting, and we'll talk about this a little bit later with your ETF, though, is a lot of these unconventional type strategies are now becoming accessible to your average investor. So you could argue maybe part of the problem, probably not the majority of the problem in the past, was these types of strategies were hard to access. You know, they were in hedge funds or they were in places where your average investor couldn't get to them. But, you know, now we're seeing so many ETFs come out that do run these types of, you know, more multi-asset strategies. So maybe that'll help over time to get more people to think about these types of things.
People love the ETFs. And so that's really helped us to take our program and put it in that particular wrapper. They love the ETF. It's great liquidity and it's great tax treatment, I think, so they tell me. And it's anonymous. I think, you know, people, it's a stressful thing to call up and say, Jerry, I want to invest in your fund. You got to talk to people. You got to talk to me. Then you got to call me up later and fire me and take your money back. It's so embarrassing. And then this is just, you know, you can buy it, you can sell it. And I actually have friends, and I have one friend who bought the fund recently. And I think just the ease of operation and not having to ask anybody, not to ask his accountant or his other advisors to make this big commitment to the private fund, I think it was just so much easier just to sort of go into his account and buy the ETF. So it's really a magical thing. Not only, you know, usually the fees are lower than a mutual fund or a private fund as well. So yeah, you would think that people, and you know, there's been huge success. My friend Andrew with his managed futures ETF, he raised $1 billion last year. And so we're all hoping that we're going to have similar good fortune one of these days. But yeah, I think that's a really good thing that these strategies are available in something that people want to invest in and feel comfortable investing in. And so I'm really, really happy. I think we need to do more. You know, we need to do more of these. We should do a stock only, long, short, trend following stock only, long, short commodities maybe. So I think we'll actually come out with more. We're pretty fired up and happy and excited about this opportunity.
I'm just curious about your evolution as an investor. I mean, if you look back at the beginning, I know you were in the Turtle Trader trading program pretty early, so maybe this wasn't true, but did you start out as kind of a stock and bond investor and then you had an evolution, or is this something you've pretty much always been doing?
So obviously I was really interested in investing, and I, in my 20s, and so I was in public accounting out of college, and I would watch Wall Street Week, and I loved Wall Street Week, Marty Zweig. He was on Wall Street Week. He was writing books, newsletters. I would read these newsletters, and it was all stock focused and centered. But then I started reading about trend following, and I would say, yeah, oh, I love this trend following. This really sounds good. You know, it just really spoke to me with the small losses and going with the trend, this objective way of looking at the markets, not predicting, following price. And then, you know, you sort of get more into it and you learn about leverage and currencies and shorting. And you're like, I was like very open-minded. I was like, oh, okay, I like this. Shorts, obviously that can work. You'd have trends on the short side. And I thought in the diversification with the currencies, commodities and interest rates, I thought this was just great stuff. You know, I too was heavily influenced and kind of polluted and corrupted by the Wall Street and, you know, stocks and long only and 60-40, and this is how stocks act. And stocks are so much different than the other markets, which I don't believe. But I too am kind of always catching myself falling back into that trap of how we're sort of raised to think a certain way about stocks and the market. You know, that bothers me when people say the market. I trade 300 markets and a lot of currencies, commodities. So I don't like to hear the market as if, you know, the stocks are the center of the universe. So I rebel against that and I don't really like it. But I believed and loved, you know, trend following and thought it was the greatest thing ever when I first read about it. And so I never really went through a phase of value or buy and hold and 60-40 and all the traditional stuff. Although I did have some of that in my head. And there has been times, obviously, where I thought owning stocks and buy and hold was a good idea, but I try to fight against that because I really don't agree with that.
You alluded to this a little bit earlier, but can you talk about how, at a high level, how you think about constructing a trend following portfolio to manage your money?
Well, I think I've just gone to an extreme. You know, I took the philosophy and tried to understand it, and I just said, then I want to be an extremely diversified trader. I want to trade individual stocks, trade hundreds of markets, and create a very diverse, safe portfolio of longs and shorts. And then I want to let those profits run in a sort of a classic extreme way. And, you know, you have to be more long-term these days. And then that means you're going to have a lot of volatility and a lot of profit give back. And it's going to be very painful. And your clients are going to hate it. I'm going to hate it. But it's kind of like the right thing to do based upon our analysis and our back test and our research. So we have to do it. And yeah, so I sort of pride myself on being willing to do all the hard things and the uncomfortable things, which mainly is just sitting with very big winning positions and not getting out too quickly. I mean, in my opinion, that's 95% of it. And that's what people rebel against, even everyone. Everyone gets out of their good positions too quickly. People talk about it all the time. Whenever I talk to people, I can see people in the audience just shaking their head. Yep, that's my big mistake. Regardless of what your strategy is, you know, people got out of, you know, Apple and Amazon, obviously, too quickly. We all do it. So you need to really fight against that. But I just think more of a systematic approach, rules-based approach, and it just always spoke to me and something I've just done for so long that it's just second nature. I can't imagine not being that person now. And I sort of really get a kick out of debating and arguing with people on Twitter and Spaces and podcasts and whenever I get the opportunity to be the one person standing up for this crazy strategy that really is frustrating because the big profits, you know, we definitely let nice profits turn into small profits or even losses because we say to ourselves, it's the right thing to do. It's following these rules. And sometimes the rules just fail tremendously, but we have to keep doing it.
Well, we're value investors. So you're going to definitely see us nodding our heads in terms of getting rid of winning positions too quickly. That's something I think all of us do in value.
Yep.
So the major asset classes you're invested in would be stocks, bonds, commodities, and currencies?
That's right.
Okay. And then how do you think about within those, how many different things, like obviously there's a lot of currencies you can invest in. There's a lot of commodities. How do you think about like how broad to be within those?
A lot of it just is going to depend upon how many markets are in that category. So there's about 50, 60 commodities, 50, 60 currencies, 30, 40 bond interest rate futures and ETFs I can get my hands on. And then there's 1,000 stocks. So you can overwhelm your portfolio with the stocks because there's so many of them. So I try to have more of a balanced portfolio and say how many. There are lots of stocks. I can get a lot of diversification. I tend to do mostly commodity-related stocks. But I try not to overwhelm the portfolio with too many stocks. But right now, it's about, I'd say, 50%. I'd say because there are so many stocks to choose from a mathematical and a system-building, objective, back-testing point of view, you can justify half your portfolio being in stocks. Stocks are worth it because you're just going to get so much more diversification. You know, like right now, we're long uranium, lithium, coal. These are sort of commodity-related stocks where the commodity doesn't exist in the futures. So if we're not in some of these companies, we're not going to participate in that particular commodity move. So there's some real diversification out there if you dig deep and cultivate this portfolio approach where your bottom line is strictly 100% strictly diversification. So it is true that all my stocks are down today. Thankfully, I've got some shorts and I'm flat some stocks. But over time, you know, stocks, they have their own personality. They're not going to necessarily look like the S&P on a long-term basis. And so you can really get some. And then you overlay the trend following piece on top of it. Then the stocks really start looking different from the benchmarks. There is true diversification. Like last year, we were short every bond future possible. No diversification in that sector. Long the dollar. No diversification in that sector. Commodities were more of a mixed bag, but stocks, you know, a lot of longs, a lot of shorts. And so sometimes the stocks will actually give you more diversification than the other markets. So, and then sometimes around COVID, it couldn't have been worse. I mean, probably long every stock in the portfolio, they all got crushed. And so it's just one of those things where if you can dream it up, it's going to happen eventually in the markets, and you just need to be prepared for it.
You mentioned the individual stocks, and that's something that makes you unique, you know, among trend followers. Like, I don't think a lot of trend followers do the individual stocks. A lot of them are doing indexes. What do you think are the big advantages? Is it just you have more things to choose from when you're looking for the trends you're looking for?
Right. I mean, you know, by definition, the index is an average, and you know, it's going to have a muted move. It's not going to give you that outlier move that if you traded all 500 of those stocks, you know, you'd be long some of them, you'd be flat, you'd be short some of them, because they're all having their own trends. So I think the legitimacy of overlaying a trend following strategy on top of something like the S&P index is a little shaky. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. You forego the diversification you could possibly get by trading them individually. You're not going to get the outlier moves. You know, we had Tesla a few years ago that was just an amazing, one of the biggest trades of all time. And having that buried inside an index, well, at the time it wasn't even in the S&P, but you know, having these big moves kind of muted and buried inside of an index doesn't work for trend following. If you have an opinion on the market, and if you're long only, and you think the market itself is going to go up, okay, sure, fine. But we're sort of hunting these outlier trades and trying to, you know, make a lot of money on maybe 10% of our trades, 10% of our positions. So it really lends itself more to breaking open that index and trading each individual one. And we have a sizing algorithm that we'll use, which is going to have a beneficial impact on our profitability as well. So you just lose all of it. No CTA would trade the dollar index, you know. You're not going to trade the dollar. You're going to trade 30, 40 different currencies. Some are up, some are going down, lots of diversification. No CTA is going to trade the commodity index in lieu of grains, crude, heating oil, unleaded, natural gas, coffee, sugar, cocoa with these huge moves this year. And yet you throw up this stupid S&P index or these stock indexes for some reason. They embrace them. I taunt them and criticize them and make fun of them. They're smart just to ignore me.
I'm curious. You mentioned before you recently brought an ETF to market. And I'm just wondering, how did that process work with your strategy? I mean, are you able to pretty much do everything in an ETF format that you're able to do with your overall strategy? Or did you have to adapt it somewhat to the ETF market?
We didn't really adapt it very much. You know, we have those acquired fund fees. So we eliminated two or three different ETFs. But it is a daunting task, because I think it was like one of the first times, if not the first time ever, that a ETF was created with a combination of a lot of futures and a lot of securities. So it was difficult to find a market maker and with the infrastructure to handle that, to hedge that portfolio. And but it is over 300 markets. And so on days where we have share creation, you know, we have additions or redemptions, there's a lot of, you know, activity to do the adjustment trades to account for the new equity, you know, in 300 markets. And a lot of those are not in the US. So it is quite a hassle. And we earn our 100 basis points, but we were really happy to, and we would go to the market makers and say, look, if you want us to eliminate some markets and or make it easier for you, fine. But they were like, no, keep doing what you're doing. We can handle it. And so far it's been really good, but it's a very unique product. And I mean, literally, we interviewed, you know, a handful of market makers, and we have found one willing to do it. So very unique product, very unique project. So hopefully we get some credit for it.
Yeah, you know, we had an ETF at one point, and it was much more plain vanilla than yours. It was just long-only stocks, but it was a huge learning process, like understanding all the things that go on behind the scenes to make the ETF work, the custom create and redeems and, you know, everything the market maker does. I mean, there's a lot to it behind the scenes that, you know, a lot of individual investors who invest in ETFs don't see.
Oh, that's right. There's so much going on, and it's such a busy thing. I try to insulate myself from that, so I'm sitting in my little cubicle, just worrying about the markets and just trying to find maybe some more stocks to add or subtract, and looking at the systems and everything. And so I try to farm all of that admin and all that other work out to other people. So that's one of the benefits of being the CEO, I guess. But I'm very appreciative of all those people involved. It's a lot of work.
And so in your liquid portfolio, outside of in the trend following strategy, do you do anything else, or is it pretty much all invested, you know, in your funds or, you know, in strategies you run using trend following?
Well, it's pretty much that, Aaron. I have other traders and hedge funds and trend followers that I invest in as well. People that I know and understand, I try to maybe start up CTAs, and I interview them pretty heavily and make sure that they kind of agree with me on the fundamental principles of proper trading, what it all means. But yeah, I do some of that as well. And then, then that's about it, I think.
Yeah.
I really dislike paying high fees. So, I try not to. At one point I had all of my investments in a sort of fund of funds, and we actually were running it as a fund of funds with a lot of hedge funds, a lot of CTAs. But I sort of stopped doing that when I sort of realized all the fees that I was paying. But yeah, I guess I am very much cash, CTAs, and real estate, pretty much.
I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on leverage? You know, we've had a lot of people who run sort of absolute return type strategies with minimal drawdowns. And, you know, we've talked a lot with them about the idea of applying leverage and maybe, you know, levering up the return a little bit, you know, when you have that consistency. I'm just wondering, how do you think about the idea of leverage with your portfolio?
Well, leverage is inherent and necessary for the CTA trend following portfolio, because so many of the markets are that we trade, the currencies and the bonds have very low volatility. So we have to raise those up. We lower the stocks and fit the commodities in there just so. And I think that the initial choice of leverage for a CTA program is the most critical choice. You know, you really need to follow your system and follow those rules, and then that's going to be severely impacted by your risk. So if you're trading too large and risking too much, it's going to have a negative impact on your ability to follow those rules. And you know, some people I know are out there, you know, a 20-30% negative month, no big deal, but that would be a big deal for me, and it would make me really probably deviate from my plan. So for me personally, I need to choose an amount of leverage and amount of risk that is, you know, typical day is 50 basis points plus or minus, like really, really small, not getting too crazy. So I think there's nothing more important to any investor, regardless of how you trade or manage your money, is to get that daily, you know, what am I living with daily? 1% plus or minus per day on average, or something even less than that. That's the one discretionary. I don't believe in discretion. I believe there are right ways to do things, wrong ways to do things. We should pursue those things. I don't think everything is created equal. I never would say personally, oh, there's many ways to do things. You should just do what makes you feel good. I hear this all the time. It's the worst advice ever. I'm not saying I'm doing things correctly. I can always learn and get better, but that's my pursuit as a human being, as professional, to get better every day, not to sort of say, well, you know, I hear what other people are doing. Maybe it's better, but my way is fine too. No, I'm going to research that and make sure that I'm not missing something. So I'm very down on, you know, kind of even the idea of you should trade something you should manage your money in a way that is that you could actually do it, you know, because I think that that just allows people to manage their money and trade in a way that is suboptimal because someone has told them it's okay if your rules are sketchy and not that great because it's what you like, you know, then you shouldn't trade. You should give your money to someone else who's disciplined and can hang in there and suffer volatility and drawdowns and not deviate from the plan. But the one area that I would say is totally discretionary is your choice of leverage. And Richard Dennis told me in 1983, you know, everyone thinks they can handle more volatility than they can handle. And that's the one thing I've learned over the years is that whenever I got into trouble, it was totally due to trading too large, too much leverage, too much vol. And then it impacted my discipline to following my rules. And so it's just really, those two things are really the most important.
Yeah, that whole idea of, you know, knowing what your limits are and the rural emotion plays in investing, that's such a huge part of no matter what strategy you follow. You know, we've had long only guys on here and it's trend following, like understanding what your limitations are as a person is such an important part to setting your personal investment strategy. And it goes both ways. You know, obviously people who are running long only have the problem of I'm going to lose a lot of money. I'm going to panic. I'm going to sell. People who use more the more trend following type strategies that are more consistent have the problem of if I'm judging myself against the S&P 500, I'm going to cause myself problems because I'm that's not the type of strategy I'm running. So I just think no matter what whatever way we look at it, like this emotional part becomes a huge part of everything.
I think one thing that people need to really ask themselves is maybe they're just not cut out for managing their money or they're not cut out for trading. So don't do it. I mean, I think that's fine, you know, but that is like a given. No, we're all going to do it. We're all going to be in charge of our money. So let's just find a process that we can handle and we'll do it. We'll be consistent, even if it's a process that's not very good. I would like to suggest that if you're not good at it, if you can't suffer, if you can't stick to something when you lose money, get out of it. Don't even manage your own money. Give it to someone else. You're not set up to do it mentally. And I don't think there's enough people admitting to that. I think it's really dangerous to try to fool yourself into thinking that lots of things work and everything is created equal. It's not true. There is right ways and wrong ways to do everything in life. We should be pursuing those right ways. And sometimes we're just not cut out to manage our own money or, yeah.
Just a couple more before I hand it back to Justin. I want to go back to the real estate because you mentioned you probably have maybe 50% of your assets or something like that in real estate. Is that properties you own for your own enjoyment? Is that income-based real estate? What is that?
No, it's like properties I own, you know, around the country, New York, Florida, fun places to go, building memories with my family. That's fun, you know. Beach houses and things like that. So it's, I think what happens though, over time, you just collect these things and then it's not a well thought out plan, at least not in my situation. Then you start to see the, you know, the cost of ownership, you know, as it relates to real estate taxes and upkeep and insurance. Oh my gosh, insurance. You know, feel sorry for me for having homes in Florida. Because
I've heard there's been big problems in the insurance market in Florida right now.
Yeah. So I'm really, to do it over again, you know, I would sit down and have more of a plan and talk about the problems of ownership and maybe, you know, the sort of the Uber model of don't own things, just rent things or Airbnb things or go to really nice hotels. I think it's really difficult to get rid of these things in your life. You know, that's, I guess, is what I'm saying. People get used to them. Your family loves them. You have these memories. You have these times you spend time together. And it just needs to, a lot of these purchases are emotional. You know, hey, this will be fun. And it's a small part of our net worth. But then after 20, 30 years, you add them all up. It's a big part of our net worth. Each in one individual was small. But, once again, I'm great on the processing and the rules-based and thinking ahead as relates to the trend-following piece, not so good as related to the real estate piece. These were emotional, fun things that, oh, crap, now they kind of add up. And now what are we going to do with all of this? And it's a real hassle with the overhead and keeping these places, you know, functioning properly, looking nice and, you know, at a high standard.
Yeah, no, to your point, like once you get the joy out of a place like that, it's like you just don't want to get rid of it. You know, even if you're not using it as much or whatever, I'm sure it can be difficult to get rid of it once you've enjoyed the time in it.
Yeah, and you got family members who are, you know, maybe a subtle pressure as well.
But I think the good part for you is because you're running trend following on the other half of your portfolio, you know, you're doing a really good job of managing risk there. So if there were to be some sort of, you know, problem in the real estate market or something, at least you're not, you know, long stocks in the other part of your portfolio. At least you've got, you know, at least you've got that solid, consistent return.
That's right. And although I am always looking for some real estate stocks to short to sort of hedge myself. Maybe one of these days, you know, after I'm long gone, maybe in, you know, 50 years, there will be more the ability to short individual real estate properties or cities, or, you know, there'll be more financialization of real estate to where you can really hedge yourself better. But I tell my relatives, like, don't buy, you know, it's too late. We're going to have a downturn in this real estate. Like, don't do what I do, just do what I say. So, But yeah.
Just one more before I hand it back to Justin. Do you do anything in like venture capital, investing in startups, you know, angel investing? You do anything like that?
No, I don't. I don't do anything. I talk bad about it, actually, because, you know, it's not transparent, not marked to market. Can't take a small loss. So I don't really like those type of things. I tout the ideas that I think there have been studies where people have said private equity is you can get the same returns from private equity and same similar correlation just by with the small stocks, leveraging up small stocks or something like that. So I really haven't done a lot of that. And when I did do it, I failed at it. So I've never had a good attitude towards those type of investments.
When you think about your overall net worth, do you consider the business at all and what the, you know, the income that's coming from the business now and in the future? Or is that sort of separate, you know, not really on the balance sheet because that's just what you've done for so long? You don't really consider it part of the overall, I guess, net worth value.
Well, this, you know, these trading businesses can, you know, make a lot of money and kick off a lot of money, manage money for clients. So it's going into my bank account, which I am then including into my net worth. So, oh yeah, I think it's great. People always ask me, like, you know, how do I trade my money to make a lot of money? Now, with Richard Dennis, we were making about 200% a year with tremendous risk and leverage. And you really could create a lot of wealth just by trading. But my wealth came not from my trading very much, because as soon as I left that turtle program, we were just trying to make 15 or 20%. I kind of went, you know, in 1988, I went from making 200% a year to instinctively realizing that I only want to make 15 or 20. It wasn't like I didn't realize that we were being crazy people, you know, trading with such leverage. But I made my money by managing other people's money, really, not so much managing my own and leveraging it up and trying to make 200%. So getting into a good, solid business, especially hedge funds and managing money and getting that incentive fee, you know, that was pretty sweet back in the day. That 2 and 20 thing was pretty darn sweet. And that's how you really do well is, you know, when you make that money and you put it in your bank account, and then even if you do trade it and put it into your funds, you know, you want to have clients and you want to have a volatility that's pretty low and this consistent 15, 20% a year. So you're not going to get too rich. You're just going to maintain your wealth. But yeah, so I got wealthy by, thanks to other people managing billions of dollars. That's the way to do it.
Speaking of 200% a year, not that this is doing this anymore, but had you ever considered or looked at Bitcoin or any of the cryptocurrencies?
Of course. I love them. I trade them. I left out that I created a fifth category: currencies, commodities, stocks, bonds, crypto. So I trade Ether and Bitcoin futures and a handful of stocks that are in, would be considered in this particular industry. So I separated it out, and I think they're wonderful. I am a fiend, and I'm obsessed with diversification. So I love Bitcoin. It's a perfect market for a trend follower to trade. You can't even pretend to understand it. You can't even ever feel guilty by taking a loss, because no one knows why, what these markets are really about and where they're going to go and what makes them go up and down. So it's the perfect trend following market. But I really, yeah, I hope it can expand. And right now, the stocks that I trade are sort of overly correlated to Bitcoin itself. So hopefully over time, that companies that are involved in blockchain and crypto are not so correlated to Ethereum and Bitcoin itself. That would be a big improvement from my portfolio's point of view. I don't think you should be afraid of these things at all, especially if it's futures. You know, I think that's what happened is old hedge fund guys like me, we didn't understand how to set up a Bitcoin account. And but as soon as they come out with the future, like, oh, we're all in on that. I mean, we trade futures all day long. And it was just so easy to trade. And that, yeah, I think it's wonderful. I hope it keeps growing. So this fifth sector that I have really becomes material, like the currencies and the commodities.
With assets like that that have a lot more volatility, like does the band, your buy and sell, you know, triggers, do they adjust based on the amount of underlying volatility of the asset? Or how does that sort of look different maybe than traditional assets that you're in?
No, the band doesn't need to change. What needs to change is the size of the position. So the typical CTA, I'd say like maybe like all of them, they size the positions inversely to the volatility. So our positions in high volatile markets are really small. And our positions in markets that have low volatility, like short-term interest rate, our position would be really large. So when you look at the two positions, the euro dollar or the bond versus the Bitcoin, essentially it would be the same position risk-wise, because one is Bitcoin is traded really small, bonds are levered up really high to make it kind of the same thing, the same potential profit, the same risk. And that's the genius, one of the geniuses of trading stocks and bonds and currencies and commodities with a trend following program. It's not just trend entries and trend exits, it's the sizing as well. Back in we made 15%, and it was the early 90s, 93, yeah, sorry. And it was all in coffee. We made 15% in coffee. And I had this one client who was very large, and it was a sovereign wealth fund. And they were like, hey, why did we break even? And then all your other clients made 15%. I said, because you didn't trade coffee. You told us you couldn't trade commodities. And I said to them, remember I told you that, and they said, well, commodities are very volatile. And I'm like, yeah, they're volatile, but we will size them smaller because they're volatile. We'll trade them smaller and you'll get the same impact. They said, oh, okay, start trading commodities. So people get religion once they miss out on profits, and they miraculously all of a sudden understand this sizing algorithm and philosophically how it works. And it's just beautiful. A trend follower can throw any market into the portfolio. Unlike buy and hold, you know, maybe you can throw gold in there. Maybe now, you know, we can throw Bitcoin in there because it has a positive history of buy and hold. But with CTAs, you can throw any market in there, and trend following with its entry, exit, and sizing algorithms, it converts them all into profitable contributors, not just helping with diversification, but corn, which is would be a total failure on a buy and hold level, it is just as equal a contributor profit-wise as any stock or any other market, as long as you use trend following. So that's one of the big, huge benefits of trend following is there's no dead markets. Everything contributes diversification-wise and profit-wise.
The last couple of questions here are kind of going to bring us back out of the strategy, I guess, discussion and more about some of your views on giving and gifting and things like that. So the first one is, and you know, this can kind of be somewhat of a delicate subject with some people. I don't think this is going to be necessarily for you, but this idea of your views of leaving money to your children or grandchildren. Like some of the guests we've had on, you know, their ultimate goal for their kids has been, you know, putting them through college. Then after that, they feel like they've given them at least the, you know, help pay for education, and then they're sort of on their own. Others, you know, they do have a view that they would like to leave something to their children if money is left over or their grandchildren. So I'm just wondering, do you have any views on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm sort of in the middle, you know. I wasn't smaller gifts to the children, you know, nothing too crazy. I think it's, like I said earlier, I think it's very important. And if some people I've met over the years, they kind of grew up with wealth and from day one, and their parents grew up with wealth. So to have this sort of mentoring relationship with people who, like my dad ran a gas station. So all of a sudden I'm making millions of dollars, you know, I need help. And I have friends who they have three or four generations of really being wealthy and going to country clubs and, you know, knowing exactly what to do and having experienced all of this. So I think that's really important to talk to people, get a mentor in that regard. If you get, you know, fortunate and you start making money and have these decisions to make about how much to leave and how much to gift to people. And I definitely, you know, my wife and I, our parents didn't really help us a lot, you know, they didn't help us. And we had to figure out the world on our own, kind of. And it worked out great. You know, we both did really well. And so when you take that away from your children, you know, that's a negative. So you don't want to take that away. You want to make them struggle and learn how life is. But then on the other hand, you love them and you want to help them. And you don't want to not give them a leg up in life and help maybe with the first house or whatever. But it's a really difficult thing. And it's different for everybody, and it's probably different for every child. But people who are part of families with multiple generations of wealth, they've gone through this and they know it. They're still making mistakes possibly, but if you're making money and creating wealth as a first time person in your family, like me, you really need to seek out guidance.
Do you have any causes or charitable organizations that you view yourself supporting?
I think, you know, everybody needs to find those, and they're out there, and we do. And it's really part of a good part of life. And my wife is very charitable and interested in certain things. And that really helps too, to have a wife or a spouse who can help in those areas and becomes really interested in that. And I think investing in the community and knowing people and, you know, I've done it both ways. I've supported international organizations and tried to really make a difference all around the world, let's say. I just felt like maybe I was going to have more influence if it was closer to home. Mm-hmm. I think that really helps. You know, one of the things that I've come up with these kind of ideas, one is like, I love to give money in things where I'm not going to get a charitable donation receipt. I think so many times in life, you need to just help people, give people what they need, give them some cold hard cash when they need it, and it's not tax deductible. And you may never hear from them again. And I think that's what you want to, that's where I've gotten a lot of, felt good about some of the giving. I've given millions of dollars away and then wondered, was that really a good investment? And then sometimes I'll give thousands of dollars away to someone who needs it for a meal or to get a car so they can start earning a living with Uber. And so sometimes you feel like, oh yeah, some of these smaller gifts are the most important ones because you had that human connection and it was kind of off the wall, off the beaten track, you know, something, you know, I think it's sort of counterintuitive. Some of the best gifts were there's no way we're going to ever get a receipt so we could write it off on our taxes. And I think that's where the rubber meets the road. If you're willing to help your fellow man in that particular way, I really want to feel good about these investments, and you sort of want to call them investments in other people and other organizations. And sometimes it's that's the best way.
Yeah, you know, in general, like I found that too, like, you know, versus doing something yourself with somebody you know or somebody you personally can help versus just writing a check and having it kind of go off to some charity, you know, that's obviously very good as well. But, you know, sometimes doing that directly in your life can be the better approach. As we wrap up, we have two old questions we want to ask you before we're done here. And one is about the idea that not everything you invest money in is for financial gain. And sometimes it's just for your own enjoyment. And we've probably touched on a lot of this already with your houses and maybe with pickleball or something like that. But I always use the example of my sailboat. You know, I have a racing sailboat. I love racing it. I go out on Wednesday night with my friends. We'll have a couple beers. We'll race around the buoys. We'll come in, you know, and go to the bar afterwards. It's just a great experience for my life. But it's a terrible investment. I mean, obviously, you have to dump a bunch of money into it. I'm going to lose money when I sell it versus what I paid for it. I'm just wondering if there's anything like that for you in your life, anything that you invest a good amount of money in, not for a return, but just for the joy you get out of it.
Oh, it's all this, you know, things that revolve around family, hanging out with my kids and grandkids and my wife. So I have a big boat as well. And it's just all about that and building these memories with your family, going on big trips or vacation homes and the boating. Yeah, it's all about that and wanting to have those memories and have that fun with those people. That's sort of my hobby, having the big dinners. You know, I love to have the big dinners with the big wines. And we had some epic times together, you know, whether it be with friends or with family. I think wine has always been a big part of really nice wines and dinners. They're really, really fun. I remember going to New York, you know, like I said, I came from a really small town and humble background, but I remember my first big New York dinner, you know, like coming to New York and going to a big restaurant, probably, you know, business related and being kind of a fish out of water and then seeing what goes on at this table and all of this fun and this food and the service and the wine. And I'm thinking, that's what I like. Boy, this is who Jerry is. He really enjoys having this, you know, in the conversation. And that's what I really enjoy doing as much as anything. And I had one of those last night, as a matter of fact. So it's really, really fun.
Very nice. Well, we just want to, before this last question, we want to wish you a very happy birthday. We hope you have a great meal on your birthday. And just sort of in parting, if you could impart one lesson on the building of your actual portfolio to the average investor, what do you think that would be?
Well, I think the most important thing is a rules-based process. You know, let's sit down and come up with some rules and follow those rules and try not to deviate from them. And like I said earlier, the amount of risk that you take is going to be somewhat influence your ability to stick with your rules. There's nothing more important than a rules-based approach, even if it's going to be buy and hold or 60-40, you know, how are you going to do it? How are you going to rebalance? I think over time that's going to serve you better. Get away from the emotional responses as much as possible. And, selling at the wrong time, buying at the wrong time. I think there's nothing more important than following a good set of rules that you need. Probably you're going to take some time, and coming up with what those rules should be. You know, you're going to have to talk to some people and do some research, but, that's got to be rules based in my mind.
Well, that was great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Yep.
Thank you, Jerry.
Yep. Take care, guys.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarboneau. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.